people who witnessed the condition of the president immediately after he entered into the hospital, people who saw what happened to his head at the scene, and the doctors who worked on the president as they attempted to save his life. And they all pointed to the right rear portion of their head as to where they saw a massive wound. Yet in the Zapruder film, you clearly see the wound on the right front part, the forehead. And that disconnect bothered the hell out of me. How can all these people who were there say it was one place, and yet here we are looking at this piece of film and it's in a completely different location?
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Today we have a very interesting husband and wife team, Tom Whitehead and Sydney Wilkinson, as our guests, to talk about technical research and discoveries that they have made into the Abraham Zapruder film, which has been called the most important home movie of all time and the single most important piece of evidence regarding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. November 22nd will mark the 60th anniversary of that history-changing event. On November 22nd, 1963, clothing manufacturer Abraham Zapruder took his top-of-the-line 8mm Bell & Howell Zumatic Director Series Model 414PD camera to film the presidential limousine and motorcade as it passed through Daley Plaza in downtown Dallas. He had no idea that he was about to record what is considered the most complete footage of President Kennedy's assassination, footage that has been viewed many times by millions, probably billions of people around the world, and footage that post-production film experts Tom Whitehead and Sydney Wilkinson can prove has been tampered with. Sydney Wilkinson was an in-house post-production producer and sales executive at some of the premier facilities in the post-production business. Her clients were all the major Hollywood studios, TV production companies, and independent filmmakers. Tom Whitehead is a post-production editor with decades of experience in feature films, television programs, and commercial finishing. They're with us today to talk about their important discovery, what it means, and the resistance that they've encountered. The brave and intrepid Tom Whitehead and Sydney Wilkinson are today's heroes behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Could you please tell us a little bit about your background, what you've been doing for a living?
I spent a couple of decades working in post-production. That's the primary issue here. Mm-hmm. Working for post-production facilities and houses as sales and director of sales, and bringing in the clients to work with us on any kind of project, mostly commercials, mm-hmm. television shows, and then restoration work for feature films, which became my forte.
Okay.
So my clients would be studios, producers from studios, executives, directors, and then I met Tom because he's an editor.
My name's Tom Whitehead. I've been working in the post-production industry since 1975. It's been a long career for me. I started as a very early video editing, where the machines were huge and they were in these giant rooms with computers, and they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars for each video recorder. And they actually let me at age 23 pop on them and start pushing buttons around. I followed the entire transition from analog broadcast to what's now feature film, digital distribution, and post-production. So I've been able to work in the industry at any point that I want to, and started in very small local commercials and finally ended up my career working in feature film.
Fantastic.
The official title I had and what would be credited in a TV show or a feature film was initially called online editing. And it's like I say to people that ask me what I do in the business, I always say, well, you know, when you go to see a movie and movie's over and you find your car in the parking lot, that's when my name appears on screen. That's the kind of behind the scenes, low level, what they call below the line in the feature film world. I was paid on a daily basis. I never got residuals. I never got a credit at the beginning of a show. But the rest of what I did in post-production was extremely varied. And it changed from when I started to where we are today. I mean, when I first started, I was working a lot with film animation people who would bring work into me, and I would, at the time, integrate their film material into a video commercial. And this is back in the early 80s. I was working in video, but film was still the primary method of doing any kind of special work in Hollywood at the time. And that's changed over the years, of course, as digital came in and the large workstations became small workstations. And now they're, you can have a little computer on your desk that is 10 times more powerful than the $1 million computer that I was running in 1995.
Yeah. So you've spent a lot of your career looking at film and video, analyzing the quality, being able to clean it up and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. That was a very important part of what I did, was supervising the final technical requirements for the final product. Quite often I would be the last person to touch the picture portion before it went out into distribution.
Okay. Now, Sydney, can you tell me how you became interested in the Kennedy assassination and the Zapruder film in particular?
Absolutely. Well, just very, very beginning for just briefly was I was an intern in Washington, D.C. in college in 1978 when the House Assassination Committee was underway. And I did my major paper on the committee and what was going on, and I was hooked after that. And I realized, wow, this is something special, and the Zapruder film always struck me as something that should be looked at more carefully because it showed so many things that the government was saying were different. And so I did my paper, and then fast forward a decade or so because life happens and things happen. And I'm in working in post-production where I met Tom and dealing mostly with film restoration people, the studios, production companies, artists, film artists, all sorts of people like that. And as we, Tom and I were working together at the time, in 2008, I was doing a lot more research. I was getting a lot more interested again. And I realized after the research I was doing that the Zapruder film has never been studied forensically. And it's just been taken for granted. And I, first thing I thought of was, here we are with all this wonderful equipment and all these people in Hollywood that are the top-notch, state-of-the-art technical people, which I'm not. I just, I deal with them. I thought, well, why can't we just get the best possible element we can from the National Archives, which is where it was housed, the original one. So talked to Tom about it, and we decided to do that. So I contacted the National Archives and asked them, what do I need to do to get the best possible forensic copy of the film? And that started our whole journey. And our plan was to go ahead and see if we could solicit our friends, our colleagues. At that point, we were dealing with Deluxe Film, Deluxe Laboratory, sorry. And they were behind it. They thought it was a great idea for us to try to do a real forensic study of it with people who know what they're doing.
And Deluxe Labs is one of the top, I don't know if it still is, but was one of the top film processing labs in the country. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's one of the huge Hollywood Color by Deluxe kind of a cornerstone of the film industry, especially when the film industry was strictly film, and the physical chemical process that film processing and printing and distribution was at the time. Deluxe has now morphed along, like everyone had to, from actual film to digital production.
HSCA stands for the United States House of Representatives Select Committee on Assassinations. It was established in 1976 to investigate the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. After interviewing eyewitnesses and doing acoustic and ballistic analysis, the committee concluded that at least four shots were fired at the president, while the Warren Commission had contended that there were only three. Most importantly, they concluded that President Kennedy was probably assassinated as the result of a conspiracy, not at the hands of a lone killer.
Deluxe still is one of the major players in the distribution and production of feature films.
Okay, so when you started to look into this, they were a supporter. They were encouraging you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right.
In fact, one of our key contacts at Deluxe had offered to us to offer to the National Archives the chance for Deluxe to take the original Zapruder film and repair and restore and preserve, which has always been one of the important things about that film. When the government bought it from the Zapruder family for $18 million, they have done nothing with it other than put it into a freezer where it's just sitting and aging.
Yeah.
The element we got from the National Archives shows a lot of damage, decay, and wear that should be protected from happening.
Sure. So important, historically important. Yeah.
It is. And it's I'll say this, it's the most viewed piece of film in human history.
Mm-hmm.
Copies of it have been spread around, and mostly because of the internet, but back in the old days, people would send 8mm copies of the film, bootleg copies that they could find, sending them all over for people to look at and to do investigation with. And here we were in the situation where we're working for one of the largest film companies on the planet with all the capability of film post-production at our fingertips. And people are still evaluating the film, looking at a cruddy little QuickTime movie.
Yeah.
So we decided to get the best quality element we could get, and it was a third generation duplicate negative 35mm blow up of the Zapruder film.
And Sydney, you got this from the National Archive. What was the process? What is that like?
Oh boy, that well, again, this was in 2008.
Yeah.
I don't know what the process is today, but it was quite lengthy. I just out of the blue contacted them. They were very nice and said the first thing I needed to do was purchase a 500-page report by a gentleman named Roland Zavada, who was a former Kodak expert in film analysis and such. And he had just finished a report for the Assassination Records Review Board in 1998, supposedly giving authenticity to the Zapruder film. They first said, you need to buy this report, you need to read it, and then if you still have questions or you still want an element, get back to us. So I didn't know any better, so I did. And of course, I couldn't understand half of it because it was so technical, but I did the best I could and realized, all right, I've done this. And so I contacted them again a month or two later, and they said, now you need to get permission from the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, who owns the copyright, owned then and still does own the copyright to the Zapruder film.
Huh. So the government didn't own the copyright
no.
of the film. The museum did.
Correct.
That's bizarre right there.
Correct. That is a whole nother, there's so many twists and turns, obviously, to the story.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. In 2000 or 1999, 2000, the Zapruder family gave a deed of gift to the museum, just donated the whole thing to them and the copyright as well. So the government has no control over it. So anything that you want to do with the Zapruder film, you must get permission from the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas.
And are they a private museum, or what is their authority?
Good question. Sorry. No, they are a private museum, yes, that we know it, right, Tom? Yeah. And they are in Dealey Plaza in Dallas. So, you know, they're housed in the Sixth Floor Museum, where Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly shot JFK. Yeah. And they've been there for years and years, and they now control an awful lot of most of the film elements, I think, most of the copyrights to them and photographs, and they're sort of the premier museum-ish for the assassination in Dealey Plaza.
The Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza is located on the sixth floor of the Dallas County Administration Building, formerly the Texas School Book Depository, which overlooks Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas, Texas. According to their website, the museum chronicles the assassination and legacy of President John F. Kennedy and the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. In December 1999, the Zapruder family donated the copyright to the Zapruder film to the Sixth Floor Museum, along with one of the first generation copies made on November 22, 1963, and other copies of the film. The Zapruder family no longer retains any copyrights to the film, which are now controlled entirely by the museum. However, the original camera negative remains in possession of the National Archive and Records Administration, which is headquartered in Washington, D.C.
Sadly, they, over the years, have become very, very supportive of the lone gunman theory, and very unsupportive of other most facts and things like that. So they control a whole lot of whatever anybody wants to do, at least with the Zapruder film. Right. And that's been since the year 2000.
One other thing about to expound upon what Sydney just said, a lot of the narrative of the Kennedy assassination has always been based upon the idea that you had one dissatisfied lone nut sitting six stories up in a building shooting down on the motorcade that the president was riding in.
Yeah.
And that was the government's official story at the Warren Commission, which was the first investigatory body that was sanctioned to investigate how President Kennedy was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, of course, there have been numerous other theories about what could have happened.
Yeah.
But the Sixth Floor Museum steadfastly sits by and protects that idea that it was one person with a crappy rifle.
They won't consider anything else.
No, no. Hmm. And if you go there, I mean, there have been hundreds of books with compelling evidence that it couldn't have been a single person with that crappy rifle.
Yeah.
And yet none of those books are on display or for sale. It's only books that support the lone nut theory of the assassination that are for sale at the Sixth Floor Museum.
Wow. That's interesting. So Sydney, you asked for permission. You had to, approach them. And
yes.
What was the process there?
Well, it took quite a few weeks. I had to get written permission from the archivist there and the assistant archivist, which I did. Yeah. And again, this was in 2008.
Yeah.
And I got the permission, had to pay some money. It wasn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went back to took the permission back to the National Archives. And they gave me a list of four or five different facilities around the country that still did film-to-film transfers to the quality we needed that were approved by the government, obviously. Mm-hmm. And that cost, you know, $800, something like that, what have you. So we got our 35-millimeter duplicate negative in the FedEx one night. And, we're like, okay, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And Tom, do you want to say what happened really briefly?
Yeah, it's sort of a funny story.
Eye opener.
Yeah.
when we got the film in, because of our connections in the film industry, we had it scanned from film to digital file, and the file size is huge.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
Most people know what HD is, and most people know what 4K is now. Mm-hmm. Well, we did this at 6K, which at the time was the highest image resolution that you could get film to data. So we got a copy of that and brought it home. I had it transferred to a QuickTime movie, and I'm watching it on my workstation, which I have at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'm just looking at it. And all along through my investigation, the thing that made me really want to look at the Zapruder film was a book by Robert Groden, that who's a very prolific author based in Dallas. And he had put out probably one of the best visual narratives with image support.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a number, there were a number of shots of people who witnessed the condition of the president immediately after he entered into the hospital, people who saw what happened to his head at the scene, and the doctors who worked on the president as they attempted to save his life. And they all pointed to the right rear portion of their head as to where they saw a massive wound.
Yeah.
Yet in the Zapruder film, you clearly see the wound on the right front part, the forehead.
Yeah.
And that disconnect bothered the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
How can all these people who were there say it was one place, and yet here we are looking at this piece of film and it's in a completely different location?
Yeah. And the back wound was an exit wound, correct?
We can't say for certain what wound went where. And and our investigation is into the images that were created primarily in Dealey Plaza, later on in the autopsy.
Yeah.
And to evaluate the veracity of those images as being an accurate representation of what actually was the state of the president's head after the wound.
Yeah.
To answer your question also about the exit wound, there absolutely was at least one exit wound through the back of the head. But the official story has stayed that it was a small bullet hole entrance wound from the sixth story through his back of his head and out the front, which mm-hmm. is still the same official story, which pretty much anybody who's looked at the Zapruder film or any other kind of evidence is pretty has been discredited. But officially, that is still the same story.
Hmm. Interesting.
So we're watching it late at night. And
actually, she was still asleep. I have insomnia like many people do. And I was up at 2 or 3 in the morning watching this go by. And I took a control of the black level, which is the darker portions of an image,
mm-hmm.
where you can brighten it up, you can electronically enhance it.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled that up, and I looked just after the president, his head explodes, and I see a clear area of black in the back right of his head, which is exactly where the people at Parkland Hospital had reported it being, that people at the scene had reported. So now I go, that's not normal.
Yeah.
This was not just a dark area in the shadow. This was a black patch. It had the same texture, unlike hair would. It had the same value of black across the whole image. And it was covering a large area in the film.
Mm-hmm.
On the president's head, it was probably about 5 or 6 inches across, about 4 inches wide.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a large area, and it's just a flat black patch.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, what the hell is this? And I go over and I wake Sid up. I wish I thought of saying something appropriate, like that's one small step or something that would have been something that would have been.
It was more like, holy F.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my God. The other thing that I just wanted to interject, too, is because we were we were at that point, I don't know if it's still the case, but at that point in 2008, we were told by the National Archives that we were the only people who'd ever asked for a forensic version.
A film copy as well.
A film copy, and film copy, because most people, were, for documentaries or mm-hmm. or whatever, what have you, they wanted the cleaned up version, and the archives did offer either one. You could have the cleaned up version or a forensic one, and I do remember they were quite surprised when I asked for, yeah, we just want the raw stuff,
yeah,
because Tom and I knew we were going to have experts evaluate it.
What exactly is a forensic copy?
They did a process with the film when they made copies for duplication on mm-hmm. 35 millimeter. And one of them was an optical process that they did to remove scratches, to eliminate some of the dirt. Mm-hmm. But it was artificial. It wasn't what they wanted to see. It was, in other words, just cleaned up artificially.
Okay.
And we didn't want that, of course. We wanted to see what was there.
Yeah.
We wanted to see every scratch, every piece of dirt, every, which is what happened, right?
Right.
Every, so when we saw the element that we got, and Tom woke me up that night, we went frame by frame, which was just blew our minds.
So you saw the same thing Tom did, no question.
Everybody we've shown it to, it's so obvious. It ripped. For a number of frames through the headshot, it is so clear and so egregious that it looks like a black magic marker. A little tiny one had been drawn over the back of the head where the exit wound, pretty much everybody believes that is or was. And so it was not a fuzzy shadow in the back of his head. It was just somebody had drawn this weird shape just to cover like a patch, like you would see.
And Tom, you think that's what it looked like to you, like somebody had actually drawn on the film?
Yes, primarily because of the way that the element, but the way that the black patch was, it was in the shape of the state of Ohio, my home state. It is just black, ink black.
Yeah, it has no texture.
It doesn't react to lighting changes. It just runs along being black. The whole time we see the back of his head for another 120 or so frames.
Right.
Before the president slid out of sight.
Yeah.
And then it's back to being a fuzzy shadow.
Yeah.
It's just during the time frame of where you can see that part of the back of his head.
Exactly. Before the head, before the head explodes at frame 313, it's just a normal back of his head. You can see hair texture in it.
Yeah.
You can see that it was the original photography.
And then it changes.
And then it changes after the headshot.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So this must have been a memorable night or morning for the two of you.
We didn't go back to sleep, I'll tell you that much.
It's like, what the hell is this?
A little more than that. More like, okay. Holy F.
Running around the house.
What the F?
So when business opened the following morning, I started making phone calls to colleagues of ours in the industry who are experts who would come and take a look at what we have.
Yeah.
At that time, we were at Deluxe, and Tom had a really nice setup. How big was your screen?
A 20-foot screen in my room. Mm-hmm. So we're able to project it optically.
Yeah.
Onto a big screen. We're not looking on a little tiny computer monitor.
Right.
And therein started our process of soliciting anybody and everybody we knew who were colleagues and friends who were experts who would come and take a look and say, what do you see? Are we dreaming? Are we making it up? What do you guys see?
Yeah.
And every single one of them said, oh my gosh, that is not normal. That is, the patch name came from a few experts, I believe.
Without naming names, these are like the preeminent film editors and post-production people in the film industry.
Absolutely. That's what I'd like to think also, because the head of restoration and preservation at Warner Brothers mm-hmm. and the same title at Paramount at the time,
mm-hmm.
they didn't want their names used because they were still employed by the studios. Yeah. And at that started a whole process also that we had a difficult time. Do you want to jump in, Tom, with getting people to go on the record who were experts?
So approximately how many experts would you say saw this, Tom?
Probably close to 50.
Okay.
I would say.
Okay. They all saw what you saw.
Nearly all of them.
Yeah.
Nearly all of them. I'll say there were two. There was one person there who said, "I know what I see, and I'm not going to say what I see."
Oh, right.
Because
I forgot.
I love that.
Because he was employed. Yeah.
I know what I see, but I'm not going to tell you what I see.
I'm not going to tell you what I see because
I can't. Right.
Yeah.
There's still the stigma of this.
Thing.
And this is something that
so weird.
Hopefully is going to be changing soon because there's this stigma about anybody that speaks against the government's position on anything to do with the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
And it's the same way it used to be with people who did research into UFOs, the tinfoil hat folks, right?
Right.
They were all whack jobs. They were all,
yeah.
The government's now come out and said, here are these things, they're on our radar, they're on our image, we see them in the sky, we don't know what they are.
Right.
That's changed everything. All of a sudden now, these aren't whack jobs that are talking about this.
So you were surprised this was just sort of like self-censorship by these
people. Oh, absolutely.
Like they were willing to tell you that they saw what you saw, but they're not willing to go on the record in any way.
Precisely.
Correct. Yeah.
Precisely. And it was, you know, in the case of the film industry, you know, you play along to get along.
Right.
And they were just concerned that would be impact their career somehow if somebody came out and said that.
That's weird. I mean, it seems as somebody, you know, on the outside, it just seems weird. Like, what would the film industry have to do with the Kennedy assassination?
Well, exactly.
Did anybody explain anything to you or, you know, what their fears were based on? Just that they were working for a studio and they might not like that I said this?
Yes.
That was a lot of it. And
okay.
and as more recent, we did more research through the years, it turns out that some of the studios had done some secret work for the government on the film. There were a couple of experts who were not working at studios, but other smaller companies who said, I actually worked on a copy of it back in the 70s for the House Assassination Committee, but I can't tell you anything about it, so go away. You know, things like that, which just stunned me, but finding out that the government had sent at various times either a copy or what have you of the film to Hollywood for experts to look at or do whatever to, who knows.
So while around 50 prominent film editors and post-production experts in Hollywood had viewed Tom and Sidney's cleaned up, digitized, high-resolution version of the Zapruder film and agreed that they saw that a flat black patch had been placed at the back of President Kennedy's head after frame 313 to cover something up, none of them wanted to go on record. Why? Tom and Sidney surmised that they were afraid of the negative feedback they would get from their employers in the film industry. But the truth that Tom and Sidney's work has revealed can't be denied.
In 2008 and 9, and 10 and 11 and 12, they still didn't want to go on the record for their own careers for some unknown crazy reason. Yeah.
Okay, so Tom, what did your discovery tell you about the lone gunman theory and the fact that it was one guy shooting the president from the back and hitting him in the back of the head?
Well, there had always been the question that came up and beautifully restated in Oliver Stone's JFK, back and to the left.
Yeah.
Our mind's eye tells us that when you hit something with force, it goes in the same direction as the force, meaning that going back and to the left would mean that chances are that bullet came from the front.
Mm-hmm.
The government worked very hard to rework that into a different narrative with alternative science.
Yeah.
that would say, no, he was shot from behind, and here's the physical reason why.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to believe that.
Yeah.
Well, here we are with this thing that's showing up in the area where people saw the wound before the president went into the ground.
Yeah.
And I'm shocked that this hadn't been really pulled out. There were some researchers before us, I should stay. David Lifton was a great researcher who worked on this, and he got an early copy back in the late 60s, for the he got a copy of it, and he noticed it even at that time. There was this dark area behind the press, and this was looking at a film copy of a film copy of a film copy on 8mm, and he could see it back then.
There are a lot of researchers through the years who have done some really, really good work on
this. By no means are we saying that we're the only ones, and
right.
We just know that we have the highest resolution element in the world.
Yeah. At least as of 2008 we know of.
And it behooves the government or the sixth floor museum and others to explain what this patch is and what it's covering up. Who put it there?
That's a very interesting story. And my partner here was very involved in going to look at the
MPI.
There were transparencies prepared for a film that the Zapruder family put together back in the days before, while they still owned the copyright and the physical film. They went and produced a videotape called Images of an Assassination, and they put it out on, of all things, VHS, and at the time, that brand new technology, DVD, and researchers all over the world would have access to this information, would be able to see the, they'd slow it down, they'd go frame by frame, they'd number the frames, and they did this very involved production, and it was done by a production company called MPI out of Chicago. And so they're called the MPI Transparencies. They got to go to the National Archives and put the Zapruder film under a light box and shoot 4x5 transparencies, which is a large film element.
This is in the very late 1990s,
And so they optically shot every single frame of the Zapruder film, and it's blown up now to a 4-inch by 5-inch format. After the film was bought back by the government, then all those ancillary elements went to the Sixth Floor Museum to be held for research purposes. Now, after we found our information about this, a fine researcher who has actually was working on the AARP, name is Douglas Horn, he found out about the work that we had done and what we had found and contacted us and included us in a book that he, one of his five volumes, that is a fantastic.
It's amazing. It's called the Inside the Assassination Records Review Board. And he's an unbelievable expert on the autopsy and on the Zapruder film. And he was also their military consultant, too, during the years of the review board. I contacted Doug. By then, it was early 2009, and I'd been doing all the research after seeing what we saw and thinking, okay, who is a researcher online who seems to be up and expert at this? And Doug's name kept popping up. So I found him, and he was almost done with his five-volume book. And I said, can we just send you what we have to see what you think, and blah, 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 blah. He agreed, and he said, oh, my goodness. And so he, at the last minute, just before publishing his book, on the chapter for the Zapruder film, he went ahead and added our I don't even know what he called it.
Our valuation.
Our valuation, said that this is something that needs to be looked at further, what have you. So that's how Doug became involved, and he was unbelievable. And along with him, Dr. David Mantic, who is an expert on the autopsy issue of the assassination, he and Doug Horn are very good friends, and Doug had introduced me to Dr. Mantic, And it so happened that in 2009, when Doug's book had just been published, a month later was the annual convention in Dallas for the assassination.
In January of this year, Dr. David Mantic published the JFK Assassination Decoded, Criminal Forgery in the Autopsy Photographs and X-Rays, a 500-page magnum opus complete with color illustrations, compiling his decades-long investigation into the JFK assassination, which is considered the definitive analysis of the headshots that killed the president. In 9 separate trips to the National Archives over multiple years, armed with the latest scientific apparatus, Mantic has spent a record amount of time examining the original JFK autopsy X-ray films. Dr. Mantic's optical density measurements prove that the autopsy X-rays have been altered to mask the frontal shots and offers forensic proof that JFK was hit by 2 shots from the right front and 1 shot from the rear, which proves that Lee Harvey Oswald could not have been the lone assassin.
Dr. Mantic and I discussed it too, and so we both decided let's go and take a look at the MPI transparencies at the 6th floor museum.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had, by then we had figured out that they were supposedly, according to the government, they were the top quality element in the world that you could see. So again, we had to get special permission.
And these are just stills taken from the film.
Correct, correct. I had no idea what I was doing, and Dr. Mantic did, but I met him there, and we didn't really say anything about what we were doing. We just wanted to look at these transparencies.
Yeah.
And so we sat down in the conference room, and, you know, they take everything away from you. You can't bring your cell phone in. You can't bring a pen in. You can't do anything. And the curator of the museum, who has since passed away, but was very... he knew who Dr. Mantic was and knew that Dr. Mantic was a firm believer, after knowing all about the autopsy evidence, that JFK was not killed from a lone gunman from behind.
Yeah.
So he was in the room the whole time, kind of skeptical. I don't know what he was doing. He was staring at us.
Yeah.
And as we got to the frames near his head and the headshot, all of a sudden it was so egregious again, more so than our film element. Right in front of me, another big, huge patch, frame after frame.
Yeah.
And poor Dr. Mantic, who was sitting next to me, he's not a very good actor. and I'm even worse, but I kept it together. I was just about to jump. I'm like, holy F. And
yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, wow, look at this. And Dr. Mantic takes a look and says, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And so I had kicked him under the table, and then we went from there, and it was just amazing. It just blew our minds. We left there that day. I called Tom immediately and Doug immediately, and the people who had helped us so far, who were experts, technical experts here in Hollywood. And I said, oh my God, you guys, you're not going to believe this. It
yeah.
is so obvious, even more so. So it just proved without a reasonable doubt to us that something had happened to this film. Somebody, somewhere, somehow, had painted over a black patch where we believe an exit wound or wounds, plural, were to hide the true story of what really happened. It was so egregious.
Yeah. And there were doctors and other medical experts at the Parkland Hospital who have testified to this huge wound in the back of his head. Can you talk about that, Tom?
Yeah, we got a chance to interview probably one of the first prime witnesses to the event. His name is Dr. Robert McClellan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a surgeon on the staff at Parkland Hospital. And he stood directly when the president was laid on his back. He stood directly behind the president's head on the right side.
Mm-hmm.
And he watched brain material
right.
come out of a hole in the back of his head.
Mm-hmm.
This was his story from the beginning. It was the story every time he related it. to anyone, whether governmental, whether under oath, or as part of an interview, he said that the exit wound was in the back of the head. Now, the other important thing to notice is that not only did we find a patch on the black on the back of the head, we're also looking at this other wound that didn't exist on the forehead, on the side of the right side of the president's head, that we see in the Zapruder film, but nobody saw it in Dallas. Nobody saw that wound in Dallas. And we were fortunate enough, Dr. McClellan has since passed, but years ago we got him to look at the Zapruder film. And as part of the documentary production we've been working on, he's on camera pointing to the famous frame 317, which is where you see on our copy of the film the most egregious black patch. And he's looking at it, pointing to it, and saying, what that thing is on his forehead, I have no idea. What I saw was a wound in that area where we see the black dot.
And to add to that, every single person in Parkland Hospital in the ER room where he was rushed to try to save his life, every single one of them said they saw nothing, no wound at all in the front right of his head. All they saw was a gaping black open hole in the back of his head. And when you look at the Zapruder film, the official Zapruder film today on pretty much any copy you see on TV or whatever you have, the back end of the left headshot, you see his right front of his entire forehead open up. It's a huge, I mean, huge. It's like it sliced his head, forehead down the middle, and this huge flap going open, and nobody at Parkland Hospital, not one medical expert saw that, which was another reason why Tom and I couldn't, we're looking at what we, the element we got, and we're reading and listening to every single interview from any and every Parkland doctor. Not one of them said they saw this gaping wound that officially is what you see now in the today's Zapruder film. So, and then also in the autopsy, nobody saw that either. So it just it was eye-dropping.
So it clearly shows that they had manipulated the original film to prove their theory that he had been shot from the back, when in fact the evidence of the patch and the manipulation of the film proves otherwise. And that goes along with what the eyewitnesses saw.
All of them, correct.
Exactly.
All of them.
Now, there was a there were a couple of the doctors and nurses there that believed that they saw a small wound right at the scalp line on the front of the president's forehead.
Which would have been an entry wound.
Correct. And without getting into the weeds too deeply on it, there's a lot of evidence to support that that would have been the entry wound for what ended up killing the president.
Then there's the whole magic bullet that is infamous, and that supposedly was shot through his neck, came out the front, and the doctors in the ER room at Parkland all thought it was an entrance wound from the neck, not an exit wound, and that sort of has been dispelled, but still is the official story.
The official story states that Oswald purportedly fired three bullets. One missed. The other one hit the president in the back, came out of his neck, and then landed into Governor John Connally, who was sitting in the seat in front of the president. Our looking at the Zapruder film with the resolution we have convinces us that there was no such bullet that ever could have done that, because we clearly see the president reacting to a wound in his neck by lifting his hands up to cover the wound. And Governor Connally is still holding in his hand a Stetson hat that, if he had gotten the wounds that he, in the film, we see him holding his hat. If he had been wounded the way they discovered his wounds at the hospital when they worked to save him as well, because he was also wounded. There were two people shot.
Yeah.
He was holding a Stetson hat in a hand whose wrist had gotten blown away by this bullet.
Yeah.
So there's no possible way that he could have been wounded at the time we see the president reacting to the wound in his neck.
Interesting.
Right there, we have proof that there was no magic bullet.
Right.
That there were more than three shots.
Yeah. Which is also what people in Daily Plaza describe.
Correct. And just over the weekend in the New York Times.
I saw that.
Did you see that? Yeah.
There's a new book coming out.
Yes. Yeah. Paul Landis. He was, as you probably read, and he dispels it as well.
Yeah.
So the magic bullet, we don't like getting into the details and about that because we don't consider it much of anything, but it is the official story still.
Yeah.
Right.
So Tom, what is your theory in terms of when this patch and when this manipulation of the film appeared? It must have happened right away.
Yes. The timeline of the film is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It actually has a lot of twists and turns, of course, and there are gaps in the possession of the film that lead us to the belief that at some point over the weekend following the assassination, that the film was altered to match the story of the lone nut six stories up.
Right.
They had to maintain that because they had to make sure that that story carried, because it would have been too easy to blame the Soviets at that time or blame the
Cubans
and could possibly trigger a nuclear exchange over this.
Yeah.
So they had to make it the act of one man that was crazy, and they did everything they could. So the film was most likely altered
that
in
weekend.
A film lab using a very very low tech solution of a way that it's called aerial imaging. It's when you have a camera downshooting that will expose a new image, where the old image is projected from below onto a transparent piece of glass. And then you can put an overlay of a clear acetate cell, which you can draw on and place it on top of. Now, the research into the Zapruder film has gone many, many different ways and many different ideas of what was changed and to make it fit the story.
And when and where.
Right. And we believe that the film had to have been altered in a rather rapid fashion. And all it really had to do was get rid of the evidence of a wound in the back of the head and put a new wound on the front of the head. That's what our belief is.
And then the autopsy had to match, because the autopsy was being done that weekend as well. So, in our opinion, it looked like it was they had to get this done by the weekend, because by Monday, the official story was coming out, and Time Life magazine was releasing all sorts of photos that are very interesting as well, but they had to get it done that weekend. So if you're doing a rush job and you have to, our opinion, to make it look like it was just one lone guy from six stories up and behind, you got to make the autopsy kind of match what you see on the Zapruder film. And so we believe it was a real rush job in both areas. And where it was done is a whole different, you know, that's still a big question, but Doug Horn has done some amazing research about it, and a secret lab at Kodak in Rochester, New York.
Douglas P. Horn served on the Assassination Records Review Board for the last 3 years of its four-year existence, from August 1995 to September 1998. He's the foremost expert on the chain of custody of the Zapruder film immediately after the assassination. In addition to dealing with military records, Mr. Horn worked exclusively with JFK medical evidence and on all issues related to the Zapruder film. Over years of study and interviews with people who were involved in the film's processing and handling, he has concluded that the film's original imagery was altered. One of the people he consulted was a former senior analyst at the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center, a man named Dino A. Brugioni. Mr. Brugioni had been shown the Zapruder film the day after the assassination for the purpose of making enlargements, blowout prints, from individual frames for the CIA and Secret Service. He has since stated that the head explosion seen today in the current version of the Zapruder film is markedly different from what he saw on November 23, 1963, when he worked with what he was certain was the camera original film. Mr. Brugioni is also adamant that the set of briefing boards available to the public in the National Archives is not the set he and his team produced on November 23, 1963.
It's impossible to track down at this point, but it just adds to what we believe is true.
Yeah. So, Tom, does the original Zapruder film exist?
I don't know. It could have been destroyed.
Yeah.
The original film could have been destroyed. A number of researchers have postulated that it would end up in some rich guy's vault to show his friends, you know, here's how we got Kennedy.
Right.
The government, of course, says this is the final film. This is the original out of camera.
Right, right, right.
The one very interesting thing about the actual photographic process, Abraham Zapruder, who owned the camera, owned a business nearby Dealey Plaza, and he went over on his lunch hour to shoot the motorcade. It was a very simple, innocent thing. There was, and the reason his film is so important is that it's the only record of the assassination that follows the entire assassination sequence from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it is so critical to establish the timeline of when wounds happened and when shots might have been fired. It sort of became the timeline of the entire assassination sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the film he had, the camera he had was an 8mm camera. Not Super 8, but 8mm. The film is actually 16mm wide, and it goes through the film in one direction for 25 feet.
Double 8.
It's what they call double 8mm, and it's a Kodachrome film process, which is a reversal film. And what that means is, I'm sure some of your listeners have seen negative film, and you hold it up, and it's very orange-looking, and you can barely make out anything that's there. Kodachrome was reversal, meaning that it was exposed, and the processing, after it was processed, it would show a positive image.
Yeah.
So for home movies, it was perfect. Mm-hmm. You shoot in the camera, you process it, you look at it. There it is.
Yeah. Now, were there other anomalies in the Zapruder film that you saw? Because I've watched it lots of times, and I noticed that when the car comes around the corner, there's a break in the film.
Yes.
Was that manipulated, or was that a natural break? Did he stop filming? When you watch it, it's jarring. It's kind of weird.
Correct. And Zapruder said that he never stopped filming.
Okay.
Everything he shot was purportedly in one continuous take.
Which makes sense. You're there to see the president, and why would you stop when he starts coming into view? It makes no sense.
Yes, and another proof that it could have been that he didn't stop and that the film had those frames excised is that when the camera stops and starts up again in the way cameras are physically, it takes a moment for the cameras to get up to speed, and when they do that, they generally get a white flash or an overexposure for a frame or two.
Mm-hmm.
As they're getting up to speed.
Yeah, I've seen that. And
And when the Zapruder film starts back up, there is no first frame overexposure, which would indicate a splice.
Yeah.
The film was sold by Abraham Zapruder on a Saturday morning to Time Life magazine for print rights.
Mm-hmm.
and they took possession of the original and a copy. There were two other copies made, and both went with the Secret Service that were made on Friday. Mm-hmm. So the film was taken away, and when Life had the possession of the film, they were going to take particular stills and put them into their December 2nd issue to show the images. They ended up using black and white, very low resolution images, and none of them showing the president's wound per se, because they didn't want to shock the American people.
Yeah.
But during the time they were handling it, two areas of the film were accidentally damaged, and they crudely put the film back together. Which brings up another interesting thing. This film, as an historic record, is almost like no other image file that exists. And yet they were handling it with their fingers. Yeah. They were handling it very clumsily. They weren't treating it like the artifact it was. They were treating it like it was a wire photo, which they used back in the day.
Yeah.
They were treating it like it meant nothing, but it was so critical to everything that followed. And the film that we look at today is in deplorable condition.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible. It's scratched. It has dirt. It has fingerprints all over it.
Hmm.
And, you know, part of our project has been to get the government to clean this thing up and protect it. And they won't touch it now.
Yeah.
When Deluxe was helping us back in 2008, 9, 10, and 11, I believe, I was authorized to offer National Archives for Deluxe to completely restore it for free.
Mm-hmm.
Restore, preserve, whatever they needed to do for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote I got from the head there was, it would take an act of God or an act of Congress to ever take it out of cold storage again.
Wow.
So that is still their official word when you contact them about the original film.
Yeah.
It's locked away forever. They never want to pull it out again, which means it is deteriorating, which is tragic. It's tragic.
So, Tom, you said that they made, what was it, two or three copies of the film, correct?
They made three copies. Three copies.
Now, this is before Life magazine took their stills and damaged the film. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so there does exist somewhere a full Zapruder film without whatever edits they made in it, correct?
There exists, without those two areas of damaged frames.
Yeah.
There exists two Secret Service copies and another copy that Time Life got.
And do you
the
have...
original was the one that lost those. But the question of when the motorcade sequence was changed, they all have that on board.
All of them, even the copies?
Yes.
Wow. So whatever they took out must have been really damaging to their case, because why would they take out certain frames of the film?
Yes, it's an entire sequence where the Zapruder would have panned the camera from right to left, and it would have very possibly exposed an area of other buildings where researchers believe that other gunmen were located.
Okay.
And that was a way of getting rid of that possibility that they would see that.
Okay. Interesting. Can you talk about your project and where you are with it? I understand that you're still in the process of getting the funding to finish it and release it.
We started doing this simply as we didn't have any greater purpose for this at all. We were just in a position where we had access to technology that very few people in the world have access to for a pet project. And we had a physical copy of the most important film of the 20th century. And so ours was pretty much a sort of starting as a research project. But the more we dove into it, the more we realized the story behind this piece of film and the other images that were exposed in Dealey Plaza and the x-ray and autopsy evidence, the photographs from the autopsy, they all tell an incredibly different story than what the government tells us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we began to see sort of the inklings of an idea to make some kind of a story about what we had discovered.
Yeah.
So we started a couple in a film camera productions. We started traveling around the country.
Yeah.
In our carry-on bags with a high-def camera and lighting equipment in our suitcases wrapped up in clothing that we took. We did a lot of interviews to support, just to see if we get some answers on this thing. And we, thankfully, we recorded them. And we have some great participants in this project so far.
Mm-hmm.
A number, of course, have passed, unfortunately, because a lot of the primary witnesses from 1963 have passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fortunate enough to get their interviews locked onto a data file before they would pass away. So we began to see a possibility to really make some kind of a program like that. The problem is that so much of the content from that film, that we would use in our film, is copywritten.
Mm.
And the copyright holders, in some cases, want huge sums of money to be able to get them released.
Yeah.
And we've seen, in particular, we saw one case of somebody who did a film that included the Zapruder film without paying the royalty or the copyright fee, and they got shut down hard and fast.
Yeah.
And that would be contrary to what we would like to see happen.
Yeah.
So we did what we could. Self-financing,
mm-hmm.
You know, flying coach with lighting equipment, sound equipment wrapped in our shirts.
Yeah.
But at this point now, we've still have been working on it, but it's a case where to move forward any further, we can't come up with the kind of money it takes to create a feature film. While we were working on this project, the film Parkland came out, a dramatic film based upon mostly true events, and they included the Zapruder film in that. Now, I happened to be working at the Lux when they were doing some kind of distribution for it, and I got to see the Parkland film on a video machine and could jog through it one frame at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that on the Zapruder film, I slowly jogged through it, and they had taken out frame 313, which is the headshot.
Yeah.
So the Sixth Floor Museum, evidently, in order to license that film, they required that that frame be taken out for purposes of taste.
Yeah.
So they have now some legal standing with excising a portion of the film.
Yeah.
And our concern is if we run in there and say, yeah, we want to see every frame, they go, nope, sorry, you can't look at 313, you can't look at 317, you can't, because of taste.
Yeah.
So that would require some legal representation, which is, you know.
Yeah, expensive.
Cha-ching.
May I add just one more thing
that
I don't think we covered? When Dr. Mantic and I went and saw the film, the MPI Transparencies at the Sixth Floor Museum in 2009, and saw, oh my gosh, it was definitely a patch and proof positive that our element showed exactly what we saw, even worse. The next year, I brought Tom with me back to look at the same MPI transparencies, and they were completely different.
What?
We were told by the museum that they were the exact same things I had seen the year before, but they had now the back of the head and all the frames during the headshot before and after were now just looked like a black sort of a shadow like you see on any element.
Yeah.
On TV or documentaries or on the internet. So it was nothing like what I'd seen with Dr. Mantic the year before. And then when we left the museum that day, I called Dr. Mantic and was very upset about it. And he couldn't make it that year, but he went the following year to double check for himself to see if it was still the case that what we saw in 2009 was no longer there, and he agreed. And he said, we don't know how, when, where, or why, but what you can now see as the MPI transparencies at the museum, Sixth Floor Museum, are not what Dr. Mantic and I saw in 2009 or what we see on our film element.
Wow.
And the other downside to that was in 2010, when she and I went back to look and saw no evidence of a black patch on the sixth floor museum's transparencies. A number of other researchers had gotten interested in what we had seen, and they went to look at the transparencies, and they look at it and go, it's a shadow.
Yeah.
These people are, you know, they're not being truthful about this. Now,
right.
There is one very important thing to know, is that we aren't the only people who asked for a 35 millimeter copy of the film to evaluate from where we saw the black patch. Another film producer and director team that were doing a great documentary called Coup in Camelot got a copy for themselves. Now, they got it a little bit too late to put in their show, but they did look at it and did the same process we did to scan it to 6K and looked at it. And the director said, sure enough, there it is, a black patch in the shape of the state of Ohio.
Yeah.
So here we are now. Our reputations are being
tarnished.
We're accused of altering it and all sorts of horrible things.
And the assassination community, and I use that term in entirely loose context, the JFK assassination community has so many researchers that fall in love with their research findings.
Sure.
Some are true, some are hypotheses, some are just out the window.
Yeah.
And it becomes almost an ownership of pride.
Yeah.
And in a lot of them are very locked into their worldview of that event.
Sure.
And to look at anything even slightly different from that is heresy.
Right.
And some of them are very well respected.
So it's interesting that is up until 2009 or 10, they were still manipulating, they were still playing and with the Zapruder images. It's that important to uphold their single gunman theory. Even though, according to polls, most Americans don't believe it at all anymore.
Correct.
Correct.
We aren't going to say that the frames were changed. We're saying that what we saw, what Sidney and Dr. Mantic saw in 2009, is what we see on our 35 millimeter frame, but you do not see today if you go to the Sixth Floor Museum and look at it again.
Okay.
That's what we're saying.
And they are the official owners.
They're a 501c3. They have a historical museum that's on the National Registry. The building is on the National Registry. They want to change the whole narrative now. For a while they were talking about destroying the building in Dealey Plaza. They were talking about reworking, and they may still rework some of the landscape and a hardscape there. Because people could go down there, and with the new technology, you see, that's the thing about 1963. They never thought that the technology would advance. They thought they could sell a story in 1964 with the Warren Commission, and that would be it.
Nobody
would question it ever.
Right.
And they had it covered. Well, now they know that so many people have gone through. They've analyzed the audio evidence.
Yeah,
they've analyzed the imaging.
The
dozens and dozens of witnesses that say it didn't happen the way the government said it. I saw it. It didn't happen that way.
Yeah, and they were excluded from the Warren Commission report. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
And other reports, too. And the House Assassination Committee that was done ended in 1978, actually. The conclusion, which you hardly ever hear about, because all you hear about is the conclusion from the Warren Commission, which was one lone nut from behind, blah, blah, blah. The conclusion of the House Assassination Committee was that it was probably the result of a conspiracy and there was more than one gunman. But you never hear that. But that is the official report from the government.
Like I said, so much of what we did was the preliminary kind of forensic work. We did the stuff into the what you would call research.
Yeah.
And we weren't looking to consider it as anything more than just that and to share with the few number of people. But we now think that there is a great story here in following that film and the timeline and the other images that were exposed in Dealey Plaza that day. There's a lawsuit going on currently with a woman who's become a dear friend of ours, Gail Nix Jackson. Her grandfather, Orville Nix, shot another film of the assassination from the other side of Dealey Plaza.
I've heard of this, yeah.
And she's actually filed a lawsuit to get the film returned to her or to for damages.
Yeah, because they just took it from her grandfather,
pretty,
correct?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. That's a whole nother story.
That's a whole nother story.
Oh, it's an amazing story, yeah.
Yeah.
And she wants it back because it's showing the other side of Dealey Plaza where supposedly there might have been another shooter hiding.
Yeah.
From behind the picket fence.
We would love to get a copy of that and apply our same forensic techniques to that film.
And that's never been seen by the public, correct?
No, it has not.
Not the original,
yeah.
No.
There are dirty copies of it
elsewhere.
It was used in the film JFK, but the copies are very low quality.
Mm-hmm.
And the original would tell us so much more. Just like if we could get our hands on the original Zapruder film and clean it the way it should be to then do a 2023 evaluation of it at that point with the imaging technologies we have today, I think it would blow it wide open.
Yeah, it would seem to me it would probably tell the true story of what happened.
That would be nice.
We'd love to try to help in some way.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great story because
it needs to be done.
You just went into it with, you know, not trying to prove a story or prove anything or with no axe to grind, just for altruistic historical purpose.
Yeah.
Had no idea what we were doing. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we were totally flying by the seat of our pants.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and so much of it has been, it's almost like I hate to use the analogy of a jigsaw puzzle, but it's kind of what it was, because all the other pieces of evidence that we've read now seem to fit into this narrative very well.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where if we were to establish the timeline of the film, who had it when, I think there's going to be more than enough time and technology in 1963 to show that they could have done this over the weekend that we propose it happened on.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this and for all the work you put into this. I hope that one day it sees the light of day, and I hope that it helps to shake somebody in the government to find the Zapruder film and release it in its entirety. It's about time. It's a long time after. Most of the people who were there or who participated in this are dead now, and you know, our president had his head blown off in public. It's kind of important point in history.
And why are they continuing to hide it?
Yeah.
What could possibly, I mean, if the truth does come out now, what harm would it do?
Yeah. So let's hear the truth, whatever it is. Let the chips fall where they may. It might be hard to believe today, but the Warren Commission report initially received a warm reception from the public. A few months after the report's release in September 1964, 87% of Americans polled believed that Lee Harvey Oswald alone shot and killed President Kennedy. By the year 2000, that number had plummeted to only 13%. In other words, only 13% of Americans polled by Gallup believed that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin. Yet the efforts of our government institutions to hide what they know about the conspiracy to kill our 35th president persists. Thankfully, there are people like Tom Whitehead and Sidney Wilkinson who continue to question the official story and expose the conspiracy to tamper with evidence and withhold the truth. Currently, Tom and Sidney are trying to raise money to complete a documentary that presents the full story of the tampering of the Zapruder film. Anyone interested in contributing to this important project can reach them at twhitehead938@gmail.com. We thank Tom and Sidney for their courage in exposing the truth behind one of the most important events in our nation's history. It's my great honor to name Tom Whitehead and Sidney Wilkinson today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive Producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.